Hi, I'm Bob Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic. For the grace of God and the program of AA, and haven't had a drink since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. Thank you for the opportunity of being here this morning. This is a great breakfast. I have been to a number of breakfasts. These are the best cooked eggs I have ever had at a... And the sausage is wonderful, and the coffee cake was... It was very, very well done. There's a great spirit in this room. I like it. Tell your husband the girls are not going to bother me. You know, so I'm serious. So if he wants to bring the girls in, they are not going to disturb me. Before I forget, congratulations to the young man who got the book. One of the traditions I wish we'd establish is that he'd come back next year and give the book to someone else. You know, I go to so many of these where we get a person, and that's not a, you know, not like, but I wish that would end up being a promotion to have, you stay and you be the man along with the old timer. I think that would be very cool that we start getting some of these things back. When three guys show up to pick you up at an airport, it's really a one-man job. You know it's not going to be an ordinary experience, and it was like, it's a little bit like Larry, Moe, and Curly, that was very cool. We got along very well from the beginning. It was very nice, but I had Larry, Ernie, and Mike, and that was cool. I love the characters you meet in AA. One of the thoughts I had is I wish, you know, when you meet someone new, you're just kind of open to what's ever there. And I was thinking, sometimes I'm not that open to the people in my own group. I don't see them new. I see them as oh yeah, that's Harry. You know, I don't see Harry like I used to see Harry. And I'm going to try to see Harry like I used to see Harry. I didn't save your life. You were ready to make a change, and I happened to be the bozo who showed up with the message that you happened to hear. And that is what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. We get ready. We grow. Most of the time we're growing, we're in some pain. And then we get in enough pain that we get open, our egos get diminished a little bit, and we get opened up enough we can hear something. And then the next guy who happens to be around, and he's the guy who said it, and you go, oh, you know. And that's very cool. I love the combination of spirituality and practicality that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking when I was 13. I was a freshman in high school. I was 4'11", weighed 95 pounds, second smallest kid in my high school class, mostly mouth, and kind of an insecure kid. I got, you know, trouble all the way through grade school. If I was in school today, they'd say I was attention deficit. Then I was just a little horse's ass. And but I kind of felt like everybody else got to school an hour early and held a meeting, and they decided what to do for the day, and I always missed the meeting. It felt like everybody else knew more about the business of living life than I did, and I'd try to catch up. I'd say, hell of a meeting, you know, hoping you'd talk about the meeting, but, you know, never did. And I just kind of felt like, you know, I just felt awkward and insecure the way I didn't know that almost all of us felt that way. I thought I was, you know, kind of unique. I was looking at my insides, judging by your outsides. And it really did seem like everybody else knew more about the business of living. But one night, a buddy of mine got a fifth, and we went out and we split that fifth, and my life changed. I mean, it was, I just loved what alcohol did for me from the moment I picked it up. And from that moment on, I just chased it as hard and as fast as I could under the circumstances that I had. I went to a Catholic military school on a college campus. We drank in high school like most guys drink in college. We had fraternities. Two or three of my buddies, we almost died of alcohol poisoning. Of my five closest friends since grade school, four of us are in AA and one's in Al-Anon. Of my graduating class of like 120, I think we have 11 members of Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a lot of alcoholism, but we had a lot of recovery. But we drank a lot. Our parents were our heroes. They were the Second World War guys and gals that came back, and cocktail parties were the order of the day. They had bartenders, and, you know, we just stole booze and drank. And by the time I finished high school, I had a reputation for being a heavy drinker. And I was, that was, you know, trouble. getting arrested, false IDs, car accidents, those sorts of things. Had a chance to go away to school. When you're young and underage, it doesn't matter if the police catch you or your old man catches you, you're just in trouble. It doesn't matter if you have one drink or if you have 12 drinks. You know, I never wanted to get caught with one drink. And thought that if I got away from the authority, my drinking normalized. So I went away to school. My drinking didn't normalize. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I was in the yearbook, had the class ring, walked out. I just run my string out. I was in civil engineering. I was going to school maybe 1 out of 10 days, and it gets kind of tough to bluff your way through a thermodynamics exam. And I was the class drunk. I had three guys petitioned to have me removed from engineering school. I mean, I literally was the class drunk. They used my room as a study hall because I was almost never in it. I was a gambler. I could hear a deck of cards a block away. You know, it was that kind of a deal. And years later, I got a chance to go back to Notre Dame, give an AA talk. And one of my buddies from Chicago, Frank M., came down with me. It was really kind of, I had some amends I wanted to make, and it was just, there were a lot of painful memories. I mean, it wasn't, you know, we just throw away more stuff. You know, Rudy, he went to Notre Dame. I passed through. I mean, it was like, that's what, drunks, you don't get a life. You don't get a chance to have the experience that you're intended to have. I didn't. You know, that was a big deal for me when I got accepted, and I just trashed it. I remember I was down in the middle of my AA talk, and I was saying, you know, I have a deep sense of failure about this place. And I said, I just figured out why. I said, I think it's because I failed. if you're looking for deep insights, you could take off now, I think. But I was due to be commissioned as an officer in the Army, and when I left school, I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19 years old. That seemed nuts to me. That didn't seem possible. I was looking for some other sort of diagnosis to get me out of trouble. But got me out of the Army. I came home. I finished school at a local university, and when I finished school, my father had a little chat with me, and he asked me to leave the house. He said, "We love you, but you're just a pain in the neck." And he said, "There's six other kids in the family, and you got to leave." And I got a job at a liquor store, and have to use your gifts. And this is the last year of my drinking. I'm trying to figure out. Vietnam's on. I got into an officer candidate school, but I'm trying to figure out what the hell, when I'm going to go to Nam, or which I ended up not doing. But I worked at a liquor store for 5 or 6 months, drank my brains out, got in trouble, got a ticket for going 80 miles an hour with a delivery truck, got fired, got a job as a waiter. The last 6 months of my drinking, I worked as a waiter. I lived, if not on Skid Row, very close by, and $10 night room, shacking up with waiters and waitresses. You know, Dr. Seuss, that child author, those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. And I'm drinking a fifth a day. I get up in the morning, take a couple of Dexedrine, drink a couple of beers. I go to work as a waiter from about 10 to 2, and 2 I go to a bar and drink beer, and at 5 I go buy a pint. And that was just my daily routine, and we, you know, went through it. And finally, one night I was at a party, and I got my face kicked in, and I got fired as a waiter. They didn't want me serving food looking the way I looked, and I was tapped. I had no place to go. And my family hadn't seen me for quite some time, and I went back to my family and asked if I could move back in the house. On the condition that I wouldn't drink, they allowed me back in the house. Now, I lied, but I got back in the house. I went through some significant withdrawal. I never thought you could get in trouble quitting, you know, but you drink a fifth a day for about a year, you're going to have some interesting dreams and when you're not sleeping. And when I moved back in the house, I'm one of seven kids. Great mom and dad, love my parents, love my brothers and sisters. I was a family asshole. I mean, they're just, you know, you talk about getting the look from your wife, you know, I would get it from my brothers and sisters and my mother and my father. There were a lot of people giving me the look. But, you were just, you know, the police would bring you home and my mother would be crying, the girls would be crying, you know, my father, I mean, just half the family wanted to kick the hell out of you, half the family wanted to fix whatever it was, and everybody's kind of at their wit's end trying to figure out what to do with you. And when I moved back in the house, I really wanted to change my life. So when I moved back in, I thought that if I could change some of the circumstances of my life, I'd go on with a great girl for a couple of years, and we broke up this last year of my drinking, and we got back together, and today she's my lovely wife, Linda. And I got a job as an executive trainee in a manufacturing concern. I bought my first car. The Army lost my physical and gave it to me for the fourth time and failed me. I mean, is that, you know, I mean, how did that, you know, I passed it three times and failed the fourth for some hearing difficulty that I didn't even know I had. And I thought, okay, now it's really going to happen. You know, all I wanted to do was get to be an adult. You know, I looked at my dad's friends. They all had stable jobs, owned houses. I thought if I could just get to a certain point, it'd be okay. This is a phase. And only I couldn't shut my drinking down. Now I'm the company drunk. I'm in a company of engineers in a research department. I'm falling asleep at my desk. Big corporations are tough places for alcoholics. They like to have you come in on Mondays. Stay on Fridays, you know. They have lunch hours. There's all sorts of restrictions that I, and I'm in trouble. I mean, you know, I'm not functioning. And I was in that job about 6 months. I quit. I took a sales job thinking it would give me more freedom. I had the sales job about 2 or 3 months. And a buddy of mine got married. Weddings were always kind of good for 4 or 5 days. And I missed 2 or 3 days of work in a row. And I woke up one Thursday afternoon and I was, I didn't know if I had a job. I didn't know if I had a fiance. I didn't know if I had a place to live until I was married. And I would just panic, you know, that just the kind of jump start of your heart that you get in the morning. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call AA didn't seem like such a bad idea. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous, called Intergroup, which is what you're supporting this morning. I got an old timer on the phone. He talked to me for a while, and then he must have got on a different line and talked to someone else because he said, could you go meet a couple of guys at a cafe at 6 o'clock? And I said, yeah, I could do that. And he told me it was a cafe I was familiar with. And then I called work and found out I still had a job and called Linda and found out I was still engaged and called home and found out they were concerned rather than mad. And I thought, why the hell did you call AA? That's really kind of a... kind of an overreaction, you know. But I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like, so I went and I met these two guys. One guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. And when you're young and in trouble, you're put in front of a lot of people who try to help you. Nuns, priests, bishops, you know, psychiatrists, psychologists, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs. And almost always you're the subject of the conversation, but not always much of a participant in the conversation. And they kind of, you know, gather information and they make recommendations. And that was kind of what I thought. I'm 23 years old. I'm going to go meet two guys. They were both quite a bit older than, well, the one guy was like 7 years older and the other guy was like 20 years older. And, you know, but I thought that was what it was going to be. They were going to ask me a bunch of questions and make a diagnosis or... And, of course, that wasn't what it was. They said, we're from Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a drinking problem. We found a solution to our drinking problem in AA, and we're here to share it with you. You know, they weren't, you know, getting a toaster for signing me up. It wasn't a multi-level marketing deal. It was just a 12-step call. And they sat me down, and they told me their stories. It was the first time in my life I had ever been tried to help by someone who had the problem themselves. And in the telling of their story to me, they changed my life. We have a lot of traditions in AA, but maybe the most wonderful one of which is that we share our experience, strength, and hope, and not our ideology, not our philosophy. It is not, we may do that through our own experience over time, but we don't generally do it in 12-step calls. They just told their story, and they changed me. That night I drank twice after that night, once on a business trip to the West Coast when I had about a month of sobriety. I was told to call AA. I didn't, and got drunk and got in some trouble. Then I was sober almost 3 months, or about 3 months, and we got married. And I think in the back of my mind, I always planned to drink on my honeymoon. I was such a phony little kid that I, you know, kind of just kept that suppressed, I think. And we got married, we honeymooned in Mexico, you know, where the divers dive off those cliffs. I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. And, I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. And, I am drunk. And I, I go over and introduce myself to the ex-president of Mexico. His nephew had been my roommate at Notre Dame. He was not impressed. His bodyguards were not impressed. I am the ugly American. I am. So I dive off the public side, climb up the cliffs. I'm up about 85 or 90 feet. I split my swimsuit. I cut my leg. I'm stuck. My wife is going absolutely nuts. I saw this headline, Minnesotan brought back in a bag. And I'm trying to, I'm watching the waves come in and the waves go out. I'm trying to decide whether to jump or dive. And finally figured out the hell with it, and I dove. And God watches after fools and drunks because I made it. And if I would have jumped, I would have died. You have to get out about 30 feet to hit the middle. You can't get out that far jumping. I didn't know that. I might have known it subconsciously, but I did not know it factually. 10 years later, we used to go down there with the kids for vacations, and we were down there one night at midnight watching the divers dive, and my wife gave me a 10-year little card that showed the picture of that chasm at La Quebrada, and it said, "There, but for the grace of God." And I said, "God, that's the dumbest thing I ever did." And she said, "Honey, it's not even in the top 10. So, I don't know. How two people can share a life and see it so differently. I was gaining a little weight and kind of getting out of shape, and I said, "I'm going to get a bike." She said, "Good idea." So I got a Harley. And she was really upset by that. I don't know why. And so I came home, and I didn't want to call my sponsor. My wife said, "For God's sakes, call Warren." I have a great sponsor. He's got 51 years of sobriety. I've had the same sponsor, actually two sponsors. I was assigned one, and I had lunch with him the other day. But my main guy, Bill, was just always more of an introducer and a friend of mine. Nice man. But I have those two men are still alive and still sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Bill's going to have 40 years in February, and Warren just had 51 in August. And I've done a lot of stuff in AA. And this guy was a mailman. He was an extraordinary guy. He was one of the most active members of Alcoholics Anonymous in our group. He did a yeoman's share of all the 12-step work in our group. Just more than most people. And I got to go on those calls, and I got given talks at jails. The first talk I ever gave, he lied to me and hooked me into giving a talk at a prison. We were just talking about that with Larry. And so just by following his example, I got to do things. It just been a perfect relationship. We're probably more like father and son today than we are sponsor and sponsee, but that man will be my sponsor until I die, or he dies. So I come back into the group. And when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember, I thought you were going to be a test. You were going to ask me questions about why I was there. I wasn't sure I belonged, people have been telling me I had a drinking problem. I thought drinking was my solution. Drinking was the one thing that worked for me. It caused me trouble once in a while, but by and large, it worked pretty well. I've had periods of sobriety. Just before I went back to my senior year, I was sober. I got in trouble. I got robbed, enrolled, and pistol whipped, shot at, thrown out of the second story of a building, and ended up in the hospital. And they were going to keep me under observation, and I was able to talk my way out of staying in the hospital and go back to Notre Dame, and I went back for my last year, and I stayed sober about 3 months. And my life didn't instantaneously get better. I didn't all of a sudden become what I thought you were telling me I'd become if I just wouldn't drink. I didn't become a great student or a model kid or a good Christian. And I thought I proved I could quit any time I wanted to, and I thought I proved booze wasn't my answer. And people say, "I think you're an alcoholic." And I'd say, "Well, I can see with the information you have about me why you think I'm an alcoholic." But some of my worst problems and some of my worst behavior was when I was sober, cold stone sober. And I think you seem to connect all the problems I have to swallowing bourbon. That's not my experience. Bourbon was my answer. I got in trouble doing it, but it worked pretty damn good, and I don't know anything that worked. Sobriety didn't work. So when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can remember when my sponsor kind of sat me down in a chair and he said, "Bob, we think alcoholism is a disease." That was new to me. I thought it was a condition. I thought it was symptomatic. He said, "We think it's physical, but we think it's also mental and spiritual. We think once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you are drinking and when you are not drinking." Now, the idea that alcoholism could affect you when you are not drinking was like a whole new idea. That was like rocket science. The first time I heard that, it did not, you know, went, wow, what, say that again, you know. And he said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous once we take our last drink or drug is we use the 12 steps of the recovery program to change. If you don't change, you're not going to stay. And to find a life that's better, you know, so you don't have to need booze or drug to do something for you that you were unwilling or unable to do for yourself. And that's what we do. And that was like the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just a very concise little summary of what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, okay, I threw myself into AA. I was going to pretty much a meeting a day and, you know, hanging out and got into the steps. And I was, you know, really after it. And my idea was, is okay, I'll buy it. I got the problem. But if I got the problem and you got the answer, I've got about a half a dozen other issues that are going on in my life. And if you've got the answer, you ought to be able to help me make those go away. And it might take a year. They didn't quite all go away in a year, and they haven't quite all gone away in 37, almost 38 years. So I got really active. I got really involved in the steps. I'm going to all the meetings. And my first year, I didn't have a very good sense of my defective character. I went through the steps as best I could. I did a, you know, fourth and fifth step. It wasn't very insightful. My fourth step was kind of a recitation of the worst things I'd done. It wasn't, you know, much, but it was what I was able to do at that time. It was okay. I wouldn't go back and redo it because I wouldn't. I did it the best I could. So when I'm in my second year, I start to get a sense of what's not working. I start to develop a list of what I would call my defects of character. Now, I got some ordinary problems, but they're just driving me nuts. I can't get up in the morning, which tends to interfere with work. I later found out that it's something to do with when I went to bed, but at the time, I did not know this. I did not know that there was a relationship between those two things. I had some work problems. I had trouble getting to work, and I had a little trouble staying at work, and I had a little trouble working at work. Other than that, it was okay. I had some financial difficulty. I spent $200 or $300 more a month than I made. And if you do that over a long period of time, you end up in debt. I just want to report that to you if you don't know where that's going. We started to have children, and I had a great mom and dad, but even great parents are imperfect, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes they made, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they didn't think of. I was loud, impatient, angry, and sometimes violent with my children. I'm not proud of that fact, but that's an accurate description of how I was. And we have three boys. Today they are 36, 34, and 27. They are all members of Alcoholics Anonymous. They are sober 17, 15, and 7 years. Their lives have just been great. Just extraordinary. But wouldn't it have been a really crappy deal if their old man hadn't been able to live his life significantly so that when they had the problem that they would look at it and they didn't want what I had? And that could have happened. Because I had those problems significantly through my early part of sobriety. And I had a gambling problem. It was more of a hobby. It was 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't a big deal. But I was making $5,000 to $10,000 a year playing backgammon, and it was kind of like a second job. Now, I had those problems not annually or quarterly or monthly or weekly. I had them daily. I had all those problems daily, and not one of those problems I just listed to you was on my first inventory. So I didn't get, you know, got what I got. One by one, these issues would come up, and one by one, I would take them on, and I'd try to deal with them. And, you know, during my second year, I had a pretty good list of what wasn't working. During my third and fourth year, they were bothering the hell out of me. During my fifth and sixth year, they started to eat my lunch. Now, I'm a really active member of AA. I'm talking, and I'm sponsoring, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm pretty much doing what you'd want or would expect a guy to do. And I'll tell you, by my fourth and fifth year, I felt like my life was going backwards. I felt like I was on the down escalator walking up. I've always been a great starter. I just not much of a finisher. And I thought that was what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, a new guy would come in, and I'd get him a cup of coffee, and he'd sit down. He'd share that bushel basket full of manure that we often walk in with, and I'd tell me about the wife, the job, the police, and the IRS, and the trouble, and I'd say, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, you're in the right place. I know you don't understand that yet, but you're in the perfect place. All you got to do is stay. All you got to do is don't drink. All you got to do is get into the book and try. You don't have to do it perfectly. Just try to apply those principles in your life, and you're going to be okay. You see that guy over there? His life was a mess 3 years ago, and now he's knocking it out of the park. You're going to be okay. And then I'd get in the car at 11 o'clock at night, and I'd drive home, and I'd say, when are you going to be okay, Bob? You've been sober 5 years. You just bought a $400 suit coat at a store that you had a $400 bill at before you walked in. When are you going to stop doing that? When are you going to quit gambling? When are you going to learn how to work? Everybody knows how to work. You don't know how to work. When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to be more gentle with your children? And I didn't have an answer for that. And I was trying as hard as I knew how, you know. And it was kind of funny. It was like AA had gotten me sober, and I thought, you get me sober and I'll learn how to be a husband. You get me sober and I'll learn how to be a father. You get me sober and I'll learn, you know, where the hell does it say that in the book? You know, but that was kind of my idea. That I thought these problems were my problems. I didn't think they were alcoholic problems. I thought they were Bob problems. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, what I wanted more than anything else was to find an expert on Bob. I wanted someone who was so insightful they could look through me and see what was wrong with me. I never found that. What happened is I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered and I became an alcoholic. And I was surrounded by people who were experts in alcoholism and the recovery from alcoholism, and they were able to see inside me and help me with my alcoholism, which was physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual. And they guided me along a course of action, which would be the solution to all the problems of unmanageability that I had in my life. But I thought, you know, before I came to AA, I had a wall built up between you and me so that you wouldn't see the unattractive things that were going on in my life. The first thing, drinking robbed me. I was a little bit extra that it took to be a success. And pretty soon I wasn't doing enough to get by, so I built a wall. The thinking that goes on behind the wall says, you like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you could see everything about me, you'd hate me because I hate me. I mean, who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me? I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outside. But at some point in time, I got sick enough or hurt enough and tired enough and afraid enough that I tore that wall down and I said, hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are or where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. Now, that's why I came to AA. I didn't know I was an alcoholic. I was so tired of me. And for the first time in my life, I shared the whole deck of cards with someone. No, I had never shared the whole deck of cards with someone. My parents had part of it, my brothers and sisters had part of it, my wife had part of it, no one had all of it. And they'd come to me and they'd try to, Bob, why don't you try, and I'd say, yeah. In my mind, I'd say, you think that way because of what you know. There's a bunch of stuff you don't know. And I'd neutralize you by what you didn't know. So I could, you know, I could neutralize almost anybody who gave me advice because no one had the whole picture. But when I tore my wall down and shared the whole deck of cards in my fifth step and with my sponsor, I made a discovery, and the discovery was that I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, not my circumstances, and not my feelings. And I started to have a sense of hope that maybe what worked for you would work for me. When you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, most of us have an overdeveloped sense of uniqueness. You have to get rid of some of that. Most of us don't get rid of all of it, but if you don't get rid of some of it, you'll look for the differences you won't identify. And I was able to get rid of enough of it that I was able to start identifying and starting to have a hope that, look at those guys. God, their lives work. You know, they're really pretty good at what they do. I could do that. You know, if I can keep doing this, maybe I'll get my job together. Maybe I'll own a house. You know, maybe there'll be a number of things, you know, that I could do. They're great guys. When I started to have problems in AA, what I did is I built my wall back up sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much for helping me with my drinking problem, but stay out of my marriage, and I put a brick up. Thank you very much for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my finances, stay out of my sex life, stay out of my business, stay out of my parenting. Brick by brick, sober in AA, I built my wall back up. And I'm in meetings, I'm going to meetings, I'm doing the talks, I'm doing the things externally you're supposed to do, but I'm dying. And I'm talking to my sponsor, and I'm telling them about 65% of what's going on. And I know in Florida you do 100, and I think that's great. You're to be congratulated for that. I was only telling myself 65%. You don't get it. When you're living it, you don't see it. You are it, but you don't see it. And I'm just dying. And at meetings, everybody's telling me how good I'm doing. I'm the youngest guy in the group for 2 years. Now I'm stark raving sober and doing all this 12-step work, and they think that's just terrific. And I'm saying, can't you see? I am dying. And I did not know what to do, and I felt like I was on my way out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wasn't going to leave, but I don't think I would have drank. I think I would have committed suicide. I was all of a sudden at 5 or 6 years of sobriety, I'm looking for a way out. I'm tired of being the guy who never finishes, and this is looking like I'm not going to finish. I know what the answer was. The answer was, I've always had great teachers in AA, and the answer was to get a better relationship with the God of my understanding. The problem with that is you go knock on the door, and God says, who's there? He said, God is Bob. And he says, what do you want? I said, I want to sign up. I said, I'm 6 years sober. My pants are on fire. Which, by the way, I may not say later, I think is a normal state. It felt horrible. It felt like I shouldn't be in it. But it is my experience that many of us, between 5 and 10 years, give or take a few years, need a second surrender to get engaged in dealing with the issues that brought us to Alcoholics Anonymous. That we do an amazingly great job of dealing with the things that we sought to deal with when we came into Alcoholics Anonymous, but we just don't see it all. We don't see enough of it when we come in. And over a period of time, you get handed it piecemeal, and you take it on, and there's more work to do. And the causes and conditions, and I had more work to do. But the problem with signing up, God says, okay, I'll help. What do you want? So then I'll say to God what all sponsees say to everybody, what do I do? Because we all want to know what to do, right? And God's going to say, get up in the morning. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. Stop spending more money than you make. Get on a budget. Which I think is an Al-Anon word. God, that's a tough word. I very harsh for alcoholic. Be kind and loving to your wife and children and stop gambling. I mean, it isn't like you have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what God would want me to do in my life. What the hell do you think I've been trying to do for the last 5 years? I've been trying to do that, and I can't do it. So what's the use of developing a relationship with the God of your understanding if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? As soon as I clean my act up, even enough to go have the conversation, I'll go have the conversation. And I was stuck in that place for 2 years. And finally, out of desperation, around the time I was 7 or 8 years sober, and I think some of this took me longer because I was young. I think I was immature. I think a person who was 10 years older than me might not have had to wait for 8 years, but that's how long it took me. It takes what it takes. You can see what you see. I mean, you get what you get. That was, and out of desperation, I went back to the steps. I took step one, and it wasn't very hard to see my powerlessness and unmanageability at 8 years of sobriety. I was clearly powerless and clearly unmanageable. The step that fooled me is step two. I had lost the belief in step two. I believed it for us, but not for me. I mean, is that nuts? I really did believe without a fraction of a doubt that AA would work for you if you did what you're supposed to do. But I didn't believe it for me because I'm 8 years sober. I'm doing a lot of stuff that I'm supposed to be doing, and my life's going backwards, not forwards. And I had to regain that belief, and I think I was in trouble, and I got more active, and all of a sudden I started to see people with big problems, bigger than mine in many cases, dealing with them with great dignity. I was trying to avoid mine. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore Bob to sanity. I had to regain step two. I took step three on my knees with my sponsor in his office. We didn't do that much in those days, but I started going to a lot of conferences, and you heard some of those guys from the West Coast talk about it, and I thought, well, this time I'm going to dot the I's, cross the T's. It was a little bit awkward and a little bit embarrassing, but I thought, what the hell? We're going to go for it. And I found out in that process that my life, you know, has always been in the care of God. I'm an ant on a log. It looks like I'm steering it down the river, but it's an illusion. You know, I can position myself on the log, but I am not in charge. And I did a four-step. The previous two four-steps that I did, one at my first 6 months and one of my first 3 months and one in about my third year, were with clergy, which was our pattern. You were told to, you know, go get a priest or go get a clergyman. And I decided to do this one with my sponsor. I said, be careful when you're done with this. I'm going to do whatever you recommend. I said, I feel like I'm dying of thirst lying next to a lake. I could pass the test. Ask me what to do. I could tell you what to do. I just can't do it. I said, I am so sick and tired of being where I'm at. And I'm ready. I really feel like I'm ready to do whatever the hell I have to do. So I did the fourth step, and we cried and talked a little bit. I didn't mean the fifth step. And one of the things he recommended to me is that I go see a psychologist. And I had a lot of problems with money and with success and failure. My father was a pretty successful guy, and I thought, I'm never going to be as good as my own man. I had pretty high standards and pretty low performance, which leaves a little gap. I didn't want to go to a psychologist. It felt like a mission of failure in my program. Hello. But I did. And I went, the psychologist said, will you get your parents involved? I said, no. I said, my parents have been over-involved in my life. If you can't help me without getting my parents involved, could you refer me to someone who can? And he said, no, I can do it without your parents. Well, you get your wife involved. I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. Probably more honestly. We get your kids involved, which I didn't want my children involved. And they were, I don't know, 7 and 4, 7 and 5. And I was embarrassed by how I occasionally was with my rage. But I said, yeah, I will. And I remember we were in the room. It must have been the 6th or 7th or 8th meeting, the two kids and Linda and I. And I was telling them how my business was going down the tubes. And I don't know why. I'm busting my ass 2 or 3 hours a day. And he looked at me and he said, why are you so afraid of failing? Pretty big question. My reaction was interesting. I wanted to pull the nose off his face. I said, listen, jerk, you're a doctor. You know, you go bankrupt, you know, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, and within 6 months you're making $100,000. I said, I'm about to go broke and lose everything I have. I'm in the real estate investment business, and I got friends' money that I've invested in my business is going down, and I said, I'm going to lose everything I had. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. He looked at Linda. And he said, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? And Linda said, nope. He asked the kid the same question. The kid said, nope. If you can't lose, you can't play. So I'm the guy who, if we're going to have a marathon, I got a great pair of tennis shoes. I dress well. I sound, act, talk like a runner. Tell you I ran some race and won some race in Minnesota. And you'd expect me to be in the top 10 in the race. And I would be for the first third. And then somewhere between, you know, half and three quarters of the race, I'd injure myself and I wouldn't finish the race. And when the race was done, you'd say, what happened to that guy from Minnesota? And so, I don't know, a hell of a runner. Won some race, he just must have pulled a hamstring. But if you would have been following me for 5 years in a helicopter preceding that, you could have guessed within 75 feet of when I'd fall down, because I don't finish anything. And it gets old. It gets old to not be able to have a life. It gets old not to be able to use your gifts and your abilities. And that's what the cost of alcoholism and drug dependency is. You don't get to have the life that's our design. And that was a pretty big opening for me. And what I discovered in that process was fear. I was afraid of being a husband. Didn't know it. I was afraid of being a father. Didn't know it. I was afraid of working. Didn't know it. I was afraid of failing. Didn't know it. I was afraid of success. Interesting. And didn't know it. You know, fear. I've done three inventories. I mean, fear was dogs, tall buildings, and snakes. I mean, I didn't have any. I had zero insight about what I just shared with you. And so I'm home about a month, about 3 weeks, maybe 10 days after that meeting with the psychologist. Really crappy day. Went to work early, went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game. I won $600. I missed dinner. I missed the AA meeting. I got in a fight with my wife. I slapped one of the kids. Okay, so you'd like to have that videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years of sobriety can do. And I said, gee, it happened again. And I said, what do you mean it happened again? Weren't you there? And I'm saying, yeah, I was there. But I said, it's like I go into a blackout. I mean, it's like these things are so habitual. I don't even think about it. And all of a sudden, I thought, you know, that's a bunch of crap. My life was the way it was because I designed it that way. I sounded like a guy who wanted to quit gambling. I wanted to gamble for as much money as I wanted to gamble whenever I wanted to gamble and not have problems because I gambled. I wanted my wife's love and affection without spending time with her. Ditto with the children. I wanted to spend money whenever I wanted to spend money and not have problems with money. I wanted money without work. Not a very good design. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I surrendered and I took the first step, I stood naked in front of my alcoholism and I looked at it and it altered me. To say the truth will set you free. Well, first it will piss you off. And I drank twice after that, but it wasn't the same. It wasn't like I could tell myself I didn't have a problem. I drank, but I couldn't get that thought sold to me. That night, I stood naked in front of my life and saw it how it was. And I surrendered, second surrender. And I was allowed to take the sixth and the seventh step of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sixth step said that we were entirely ready to have God, not Bob, have God remove our defects of character. And the seventh step said we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I have spent 8 years trying to get rid of them and failed. I don't have the power. I have the responsibility. And I have, you know, I need to be involved. But I'm the pipe, not the well. I don't have the power. And that night, you know, doctor doesn't heal. It creates an septic environment, creates an atmosphere in which healing can take place and God heals. Farmer doesn't grow. He plants a seed, creates a fertile environment, creates an atmosphere in which growth can take place and God grows. And we don't change. We create an atmosphere in which change can take place and God changes us, I believe. And that night, when I took the sixth and the seventh step, four of the major problems I was dealing with in my life disappeared that night. Such is the power of God and such is the power of the sixth and the seventh step. It was an extraordinary experience. Now, I'm a guy also that when I go on a diet, I usually go get a bag of cookies and some ice cream. It's already been a bad day. I'm just going to finish off the day. I'm probably, so I'm going to, probably never going to have ice cream again anyway. So, you know. If you can identify with that at all, you. And it's funny, I knew I had to put some other things kind of in there. Restraint. So I turned the checkbook over to my wife, put myself in an allowance. My wife had us out of difficulty within a year. She could pay a third of a bill. God damn, this thing I've ever seen in my life. New rocket science. I quit gambling that night. I made a deal with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and what I'd do at work and how long I'd stay at work. I started dating my wife. I dated my wife every Friday night for 25 years after that. That was a real live, dangerous date. No one else went out on that date. It was just the two of us. It was one of the best things, you know, she knew once a week, because I was, one of the arguments was that I was too busy in AA. And so one night a week we had each other's undivided attention. And that was one of the best things we did. I started getting some help with psychologists about being a parent. I think being a parent, having, you know, having children is like having a bowling alley installed in your head. I think it's one of the most demanding. I think it takes 125% of whatever you have. I mean, it is one of the most, it's a great privilege, and it's a great ride, but it's a pretty demanding process. And I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. My life changed dramatically at that moment, at 8 years of sobriety. My life took off like a rocket ship. All of a sudden, the guy who couldn't work could work. I had a great partner, and we were lucky. We were at a, kind of doing the right thing at the right time. And for the next 10 years, I just made money hand over fist. I made enough money to burn a wet elephant from about 1975 to about 1985. Big cars, big houses, you know, two Mercedes, big one, little one. This was my deeply shallow period. And I am the guy in the very expensive suit and very expensive tie coming to the meeting in the Mercedes thinking that God has blessed him because he's such a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. How would you have liked to have had me in your group? You know, there are problems with failing, but there are problems with success which never occurred to me. You know, arrogance never occurred to me. I was always the guy who didn't feel good enough about himself. So, I mean, there are just things that you don't... So one of the things all of a sudden during this period, it's about what Bob wants. You know, so it's, you know, you want this, go get that. You want this, go get that. All of a sudden it's about me. And that's got its own set of issues and its own set of difficulties. You know, it's a different, it's ego in a different sense as my sense of failure, my deep sense of failure. There's something wrong with me that's not wrong with anybody else. There's something I can't do that, you know, you're not equipped properly. What a bunch of hooey. That's ego in a reverse sense, and now I'm experiencing it in a positive sense. And then they, in 1984 or 5, they passed the Tax Act, and all of a sudden, the train started going backwards. And then from about 1988 to 1991, I went broke. I lost $8 million. I lost the house. I lost the cars. I lost, you know, I thought, how could you lose it all? You know, I could see that you could lose part of it, you know. But how could you lose it all? And I'm negotiating with banks to get out of bankruptcy. And our middle boy, Peter, came home from school, got drunk, got arrested for drunken driving, totaled out an automobile, and ended up in detox. It was kind of his Christmas present to Linda and I. And and he goes through treatment, and he's in a halfway house. And Friday nights, we go to the meeting at the halfway house, and I cry my way through the meeting. When the meeting opens, I mean, I'm going broke. My kid's in treatment. You know, can't you see the guy, you know, at the meeting? See that guy over there? He's got 25 years. How would you like to have what he has? You know, that little crap head Peter, who we had up for sale for 2 or 3 years. Just graduated from Oxford University in England with an MBA. And you can't get from there to here. You know, he went to 5 colleges, never got the concept of attending until the 3rd. But you don't know. I just say that, what an extraordinary, and he's not the most academic kid. But he studied for 4 months to take the graduate records, got in there, and they're just an extraordinary story. So I'm tanked. I am dying. You know, losing the money was not like changing clothes. It was like carrying the skin off my body. If any of you out there are praying to become financially successful, include keeping it in your prayer. A lot of people don't. They just want to get it. Okay, so get it and keep it. Do a thing. About that time, I asked the guy to be my spiritual advisor. He said, what do you want? I said, I want to be less materialistic and more loving. I said, I've been too competitive all my life. I said, there was a man in my life by the name of Bob White. I said, everybody loves being with Bob White. I said, I'd like to be like that. I'd like people to feel better about themselves when they're with me rather than me competing with them, you know, when they're with me. and I want to be less materialistic. Within about 3 weeks, I started to lose everything I had. I went back to George and said, we've got to talk. I said, I want to keep the stuff and be less materialistic. We laugh about that today. And I had to find out, you know, I mean, God's got had a lesson for me in that process. I don't think he had the real estate collapse to teach me personally a lesson, but in every great problem and time you have in your life, there's a lesson, I believe, for you in the process. And the lesson for me is I had to find out who I was, with money or without money. And, you know, today I would not trade the money for the lesson. I'd take both. but I wouldn't trade the lesson for the money. And to go back. So, you know, it's an amazing ride. I am, and I've made my way back. I'm self-supporting through my own contribution. I've got a great relationship with my wife. I've got a good relationship with my kids, and it's just great. It's, but if you're going to be sober for a long period of time, you're going to have your turn in the barrel. Just don't. It doesn't mean that you're a good guy or good girl or bad girl. You just, you know, you're going to be sober for 30 years. You're going to have some health issues and some financial issues and some relationship issues, and some children issues. It's life. You know what I thought recovery was? I thought recovery was the absence of problems. Now, if you think that, no one told me that. I made that up all by myself. But I did. I don't know. I mean, I did. I literally thought, I so admired some of the people who were my models in Alcoholics Anonymous that I saw them without problems. Now, my sponsor wasn't without problems. My friends were not without problems. I was kinder with them than I was with me. You know, I would be much harsher in the evaluation of myself than I would be on these, you know, men and women who were 15 to 30 years older than I was. And it isn't the absence of problems. It's a program that teaches us how to live our lives so that we can deal with whatever shows up in our lives. Happiness is usually a word associated more with circumstantial pleasantries. You can't always have happiness, but you can always have peace and joy. And I think what the program offers, and that's not contingent on circumstances. I believe during the toughest of times, and when I was going broke, it was, baby, I'll tell you, suicide was a thought in my mind regularly. I just, you know, almost 50 years old, starting over. I mean, I just, you know, I thought, how did it happen? How did you get my old man, who was in the real estate business, used to worry about me. He'd say, Bob, are you really doing as well as you look like you're doing? I said, Dad, you know, I got $1 million in the bank. I got stuff. It's great. Don't worry about it. Well, he saw things I didn't see. And this collapse was like a tsunami. This was the greatest real estate collapse since the Great Depression. This was not an ordinary experience. I doubt in my lifetime we will ever see another thing like that. But my father still saw some things in how my finances were structured and how I was living my life. And, you know, I had to learn those lessons. And when you get tough times, you get more active or less active. Thank God for AA. If it wasn't for my wife, my sponsor, the program, and my spiritual advisor, I think I'd be dead. I would not have made it through. If you think graceful, I was under my desk sucking my thumb in the fetal position for 2 years. It was not graceful. Okay, I was crying at commercials. You know, this was not graceful. I'm just, you know, but it was what it was. You do the, you know, but I kept going to four or five meetings a week. I kept in contact with my people, and I just put one damn foot in front of the other and made it through. And in the negotiation and with the bankruptcy judges, they allowed us to keep our business, which wasn't very likely. And we were able to keep our business and have a salary during that period of time. And little by little, we crawled our way out, and today it's okay. It's better than okay. It's good. And Alcoholics Anonymous is not a partial answer. Our answer is not abstinence. I think most people on the outside think what you get in Alcoholics Anonymous is abstinence. Almost all of us on the inside know that's a great start, but it's not what you get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Almost everybody can get sober. We don't have a very good record of staying sober. In order to stay sober, we have to change our lives. We have to get enough of the things that don't work out of our lives. And that involves change, and change is difficult for almost all of us because most of us, and especially in this day and age, so identify with our thinking and so identify with our behavior that we think it's who we are. Our behavior is not who we are, it's what we do. In the early days of my recovery, I tried to change a lot of things, not very successfully, and I would try and fail and try and fail and try and fail, but I still grew. There comes a time where you either have to change or you stop growing. And that time for me was that experience I told you about at 8 years. But I believe that that's kind of a cycle. I believe that there are times throughout your sobriety, if you're going to be sober a long time, that there are times where you got to have some business. You got to take it on. And a lot of us don't. Some of us, in a crazy sort of way, congratulate ourselves with our sobriety and use our sobriety as a reason not to change. Must be doing something right. I'm 30 years sober. You know, so I don't have to, you know. And when you get to that point in the road where you either have to change or stop growing, you make a decision. And if you make a decision to change, you go through probably the steps and use that path to change. And if you don't, what you do is you build an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. Chasers hang up with the chasers, gamblers hang out with the gamblers, you know, and they make a deal. I'll make a deal with you. I won't call you on your crap. You don't call me on mine. We'll talk about traditions. We'll talk about meetings. We'll talk about the steps that we'll stage out of each other's faces. Deal? Bad deal. Bad deal. But the thing that keeps us locked into most of these problems is fear. We either feel that we can't change them because we've tried, or we fear that it's just who we are and we can't change. It's who I am. And it's not. It's just behavior. It's not skin and bones. It's just behavior. You can change your political party. It doesn't change who you are. You can change your automobile. It doesn't change who you are. You can stop gambling and it doesn't change who you are. You can stop anger and it doesn't change who you are. You know, I think if I ask those of us to raise your hands, and I'm not asking that, to say how many people would like to get rid of the things that don't work in their lives that hurt themselves and other people. Okay, I think most of us would say yes. But the discovery I made is how afraid of that process I was. And pretend I'm working with a guy who's 35 years old, married with kids. And he's having trouble with doing the fourth step, all the columns and stuff. I say, look, don't bother with that. I know you're having trouble with that. I got something I want to try. Just get your mom and dad and your wife and your boss and a couple of neighbors and your kids and your brothers and sisters and bring them over to the house. And serve coffee, and then I want you to pass out tablets and say, in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a step where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine. And I was wondering if you would help. You'd have a pretty good start. But most of us wouldn't call that meeting. You know why? We don't want to change. And that's not some of us. That resistance to change is most of us. But it's even deeper than that. Not only do we not want to change, we don't want to know. So you train the people around you what they can say and what they can't say. Your kids know what they can say and can't say with a look. Your boss knows what he can say to you or not say to you. Your wife. You want to have that conversation? It's going to be a tough conversation. You know. If God's going to get a message to us, how would he get the message to us? Probably through our spouses. Bad news, but probably through your children, your spouse, your brothers and sisters, your mom and dad, the people you work with. I mean, it's going to be someone close. The universe reflects back what we need to see. It holds a mirror up. Most of us don't want to see what's in that mirror. And the great news that I have, and isn't it funny, with the experience that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we know on the other side of the fire is this wonderful experience of peace and joy. The fire is an illusion. The spiritual path is through the fire, not around it. Almost all of us are trying to go around it. We are too, and I think one of the things in Alcoholics Anonymous, we do have to be in touch with our past, but I think we're too tied to our past. I think we really have a tendency to see ourselves as a piece of concrete when we are more a piece of clay than we are a piece of concrete. There are more opportunities for us for change and growth. Two or three conversations out here before I come up to give the talk where people are saying my life is more wonderful than I ever would have expected it to be. The old timers, I'll tell you, don't make a list out when you walk in. You're going to shortchange yourself. We all have a list. We all make a list. We make it mentally. And most of us accomplish a lot of what's on that list in the early part, but there's a lot of things that belong on the list that we didn't know enough to put on the list. And that's what you will see. So what does the program promise? It promises a spiritual awakening. So how do changes happen? I think you become more awake. I still have a tendency to anger, but I don't hit children. I don't express it the way it was. It doesn't own me the way it was because I can see it. I don't have to be it. I can see it arise, and I now have a choice. I never used to have a choice. I used to have a thought reaction. My thoughts were pasted on my eyeball. It was my reality. Today, they're here. And I can get a crazy thought, and I can look at it, and I can say, wow, I haven't had that one for a while. You know, Frank Milos talks about we have Grand Central Station minds. We do not have to get on every train that goes through the station. I used to get on the train and lock myself in the club car, you know, just, you know, I'd follow that sucker. You can let the trains go on through. There's a freedom. I can't tell you the freedom today to be able to have a thought and not have to engage it. And I believe that that is the freedom that recovery offers. I believe that that is a spiritual awakening that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, that we are continuously more awake, and as a result of being more awake, we are not unconsciously doing the things that we used to do that hurt ourselves and hurt other people. And as a result, and how do we do that? We do it with a practice. What's our practice? Our practice is the program. Our practice is the steps. Our practice are meetings. Our practice are sponsorship. Our practice is 12-step work. That's our practice. And if you do that, life will present to you the work. It will present to you specifically. So one guy's got this issue. I don't have that issue. But part of his work is that issue. I got another issue. You don't have it. But that's my work. Some of us, we all have. All of us have egos. All of us have pride. All of us have fear. All of us have resentments. And our book does a very good job with dealing with that. And each of us has our own little place where we leak. And all of us leak. This program is of God. As I close, one of the things I want to say is there is more teaching. Now, people come up and say, oh, I heard your step presentation or something. We got more step presentations, you know, Bob on the 12 steps and Herb and Harry and, you know, Joe and Charlie. And as our society ages, we always mostly have been an oral society. And you become, there's a tendency for all human organizations towards orthodoxy. There's a tendency for all human organizations to become more didactic and more teaching. And we're doing that. And I think that to a significant extent, it's great and it's fine. We are more dedicated to the book, and I think the book is inspired. I think the book is our basic text and our path. But one of the things you can get a sense of in that process is that it's mechanical. If you just do the right thing, you're going to be okay. If it was mechanical, every time you had a serious problem, you just have to say the third step prayer and click your heels, you'd be back in Kansas. I mean, wouldn't you just be able to, you know, what do I have to do? Oh, you do this, you do that, you do this, and you're okay. But those of us who struggle through life know that that's too simple. And sometimes it can be that simple. You know, sometimes you just really do have to go do those things and you will get the result. But sometimes you go to do those things and no one's home. Sometimes you say the third step prayer and it feels like no one's home. So there's something about the process that we have to bring to the process and a way of being in the process. And I don't know, but humility certainly would be part of that. Honesty would be part of it. The answer is surrender. Everybody wants to know what to do. The answer is not about doing. The answer is about being. The program and the change that we have in recovery is transformational. It's not linear. It's transformational. Most of us, the major changes in our lives happened abruptly with an attitude, a change of heart. And it was not by information that our heart changed. It was something of God. And because it's of God, you can't just contain it in words. and you don't own it. No one owns it. There are people who will sound like they really know it. There are people who have the first 164 pages of the book memorized. Some of those people I would not want to go on a hunting trip with. Well, they've got the menu memorized. I mean, some of the people who have the menu memorized are dying of starvation. When you put it to practice in your life, you have an experience. That's different than the words. The words point to God. The experience, the power is not ours. I don't even think the power is Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's God's power, and the channel for us to access that power is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's a place that I go to participate and access the power, my higher power. And when I do the things that we're directed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, my life gets better, and I resolve more issues, and I grow more steady, and my life is more normal than it has ever been. Thank you for my life. Thank you.